From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You know, it's in the show, like, running from who you are is hard, especially if you have a limp. Like, I really believe that. Like, you can't, honey. Like, cerebral palsy will always catch up. She's slow, but she gets there.
For years, Ryan O'Connell was in the closet. Not because he's gay, which he is, but because he was ashamed of having cerebral palsy. His cover, he'd been hit by a car, which was true. But eventually, that lie took a toll. O'Connell, who's written for TV shows including Will and Grace and MTV's Awkward, tells us about the four-year struggle to find a home for his autobiographical comedy series, Special, and why an extraordinary sex scene in the show was so important to him. But first on the News Banter, it is on. WGA sees the talent agencies in court. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my co-conspirator and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
Well, so we've talked about this before, but now it's happened. The Writers Guild has sued the big four talent agencies, WME, CAA, ICM, UTA, over the longstanding practice of collecting packaging fees. They allege that this is illegal under California and federal law. This is a breach of fiduciary duty, unfair competition. And several very high-profile writers have their names on this lawsuit, among them David Simon, creator of The Wire, and more recently The Deuce, and Meredith Steam, who created Cold Case, Madam Secretary creator Barbara Hall. They all spoke at a press conference and talked about, in some cases, how much money agencies were making. They said, in some cases, that they didn't really know about. Meredith Steam said CAA had put her in a package without her consent, that as the show was in success, the agency was collecting $75,000 per episode, which affected the show's budget, and that the agency collected shares of the profits that were almost equal to her own. And this is her quote, "When the show I created worked on exclusively for 7 years, went into profit, CAA ended up making 94 cents for every dollar that I earned. This is indefensible." And this has been a theme for the writers. We created this, not you. Why are you making so much money?
Well, and that's the big argument here, is that these are supposed to be representatives whose fates should be aligned with the clients they represent. And in some of these examples, clearly the agents' interest in the show was not necessarily aligned with their own clients. And that is the crux of this breach of fiduciary duty claim that the writers are making. Now, when you talk to the agents, they say this was all done on the up and up. Clients know exactly what's going on. And in most, if not all cases, the client is saving money because they forego the 10% commission in order for the agents to get the package. And that's what the court is going to have to sort out in this case, because both sides do not seem interested in a settlement at this point.
Yeah, and it goes to how business has been done for over 40 years. Somebody asked at this press conference, why now are you challenging these fees? And the Guild attorney, Casey Pitts, said it's become apparent that the abuses of packaging have become increasingly appalling over the recent few years and that other efforts to address packaging have not been successful. So that's the answer to that. But I had lunch with an agent this past week, a very high-level agent at one of these agencies. His argument was that maybe, yes, packaging has gotten a bit out of control. Maybe we need to make sure that everybody's transparent, although he said his agency is transparent, but that the writers are absolutely the leadership of the Guild is unwilling to negotiate, he said. And he said it's very awkward. You know, the agents have now been terminated by thousands of their writer clients. But he talked about the awkwardness of going after a guild from a Hollywood perception point of view. But his argument, of course, he's trying to peel off some of these important writers from the guild's leadership. His argument was that leadership is causing chaos.
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly being aggressive, but, you know, some would argue that they're finally standing up for themselves. And I think what the big impetus for this is that in this peak TV era, when there are so many shows and there's so much, quote unquote, opportunity, a lot of writers see their paychecks going down because so many of these shows are not 22 episodes like they once were, and they're not paying as much as they once were accustomed to. So that's an undercurrent going on here. But one of the interesting claims in this lawsuit is that the writers are going after packaging fees going back decades. They want these agencies to disgorge the profits they have made from packaging fees, and that is potentially billions of dollars. So if a court ultimately decides that packaging is illegal and these agencies have to pay back money, not in the future, but in the past, that is a gigantic hit to these agencies.
Yeah, I'm just going to make a couple of more points. I mean, it is, this makes it an existential fight, but there are a few things that also are problematic in terms of getting this thing resolved. One of which is that the agencies, they're four different agencies that are used to cutthroat competition with each other, trying to kill each other, trying to speak with one voice. And they don't necessarily all have the same interest. They don't necessarily all have the same packaging practices, for example. And certainly ICM, one of them, is not involved in producing, which is another front in this battle that the Writers Guild doesn't want the agencies to get involved in producing, because they say that's also a conflict of interest, negotiating on behalf of their client with themselves. So ICM is not even involved in that. So I think that trying to get the agencies on the same page for anything is probably a terrible struggle. But meanwhile, I would also say they're gambling a little bit that the writers don't figure out an alternative way of getting jobs and doing business. The other thing is, you know, whatever win they give to the writers, I think they're really scared that the actors and the directors are going to go, oh, wait a minute, what about us? So this is potentially an expanding problem. It's a very dangerous time at a time of great instability in this business.
Yeah, the Writers Guild traditionally is more aggressive than the other entertainment unions. But you're right, this could be a domino effect. The immediate impact is going to be on the staffing season right now for broadcast television, where writers typically are put up for assignments on shows that are greenlit for the fall. And the Guild says they have a system, they have an online submission process, they believe they can deputize managers and lawyers to step in and do the jobs that agents have typically done. But there's another law in California called the Talent Agencies Act, which specifically says that only a licensed talent agent can procure employment on behalf of a client. So if you have lawyers and managers getting jobs for these clients that now no longer have an agent, that potentially violates the Talent Agencies Act. And I've heard from several attorneys that they're getting calls from managers saying, how do I navigate this? I've got a writer client who no longer has an agent, would like to get a job this staffing season, or has been presented with a potential job. Am I allowed to negotiate that? Am I allowed to even say, okay, I'll make a call on your behalf? That's typically a role that the agent would play. And they don't want to violate the law and have the client come back to them in a year or two and say, listen, you violated the Talent Agencies Act. I'm going to sue you, and you're going to have to disgorge all of the commissions I ever paid you.
So we are at a fraught time, to be clear. You know, one of the arguments that this agent I was with yesterday said, well, this, with all this instability and the advent of the streamers and fewer episodes in an order for a series, first of all, we're not making that kind of money off of packaging by and large anymore. But second of all, these guys need us now more than ever to navigate this new terrain, which will provide me with an opportunity to pivot to Netflix. Netflix announced its earnings. And even though they have 148 million subscribers worldwide and added 9.6 million more just in this past quarter, they did say the next quarter may not be so good, and the stock market wasn't that happy.
Yeah, the initial hit was based on the projections, even though the 9.6 million subscribers that Netflix added in the first quarter was a record for the service. And it gets to this whole streaming landscape. We saw Disney announce the logistics for its service this past week. Disney Plus is going to launch in the fall. It's got a $7 price point. And we've seen Hulu make some moves where they're offering different tiered pricing on what their service is. It's a drag out war on who is going to own streaming. I personally don't think that Netflix has much to worry about from Disney at this point. I think they're both going to succeed. There was an interesting piece in the New York Times this week suggesting that Hulu might be the best position because Hulu is now majority owned by Disney. And it also has this double tier. They have ads as well as subscriptions. And they were making about $1.5 billion on advertising this past year. And that is a revenue stream that both Disney Plus and Netflix do not have, at least for now.
I would say if there's danger to Netflix, it's more that it would spend itself to death before it establishes its originals. And eventually that might take a toll. But right now, I agree with you. There's room for Disney, Hulu, and Netflix, although I'm not paying for all three, I don't think.
Well, and just wait until WarnerMedia and NBC Universal and others, including Apple, come into the fray. Then you're going to have to make a choice.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In the new Netflix comedy series Special, Ryan O'Connell plays a version of himself. Ryan Hayes is a gay man beset by millennial angst, who also has cerebral palsy. Early in the first episode, his physical therapist, played by Brandon Potter, catches Ryan ogling one of the other trainers.
Hey, hey, focus. Save that for Grindr.
I love that you think I have enough self-esteem to be on Grindr. What would my profile even say? I'm gay and disabled. But I promise not to drill on you until the third date.
As O'Connell did in real life, his character in the show finds some writing success at a website that runs on clicks generated from deeply personal first-person blog posts. Again, as in real life, the fictional Ryan hides the fact that he has cerebral palsy. Instead, soon after he's hired, he takes advantage of a moment when his boss, played by Marla Mindell, finds out that he was hit by a car. Yes, as O'Connell was in real life.
It all makes so much sense now. Your inability to open mail, your sad limp.
Oh, my limp is actually...
Are you ever going to get better? Or is this just, like, it for you?
Yeah. This is it for me. All from getting hit by a car.
Wow. Everybody, come hug Ryan. He was hit by a car and now he's a weird sad limp forever.
O'Connell wrote about being gay and disabled and staying in the closet about his cerebral palsy in his 2015 memoir, I'm Special and Other Lies We Tell Ourselves. When he then started pitching his book as a TV series, he didn't envision himself playing himself.
He said, I wanted to be Nora Ephron, not Meg Ryan.
Yeah. When we initially went out with the pitch in 2015, I was not attached to star. And I think it's because I wasn't an actor. I mean, I'd never acted before. So everyone passed on that pitch. And then we went to this digital branch of Warner Brothers, Stage 13, and they were doing short form content. And I always thought that they had me play myself due to budget. But I remember, my exec called me the other day and was like, babe, that's like not what it was. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, I thought you were an actor. Like, I just assumed you were. And so I was like, oh, he'll just play himself. And then halfway through, I was like, wait, he's never acted before. So then I had to screen test for the role of myself. And honey, I got it. Valerie Cherish, I got it. Now, having gone through the process, I feel like I always actually wanted to act. And I always was like a natural performer. But I didn't give myself permission to want that because I didn't think that that was a feasible life path for me. And I so strongly identified as a writer. And I thought being an actor like wasn't chic or something. I don't know. I'm now fully embracing the fact that I'm an actor, that I do like to act, and I'm really actually happy that it worked out this way and that no one else played me.
Well, there is a bit of a sticky wicket, right? Because you would not want, I'm not even sure of my terminology, a not disabled person playing a
Never.
You.
And like, you know, our cup doesn't run over with like gay disabled actors. I mean, there are a few of them, but...
Yeah, I'm actually starting to think, well, what if it was a straight disabled actor playing gay?
No,
no,
I don't want that.
No to that too.
I don't want that. You always have to give jobs to the people that don't get the jobs.
Right.
It's not that complicated for me. Like gay actors have a harder time than straight actors. That's just the way it is. So I would always want to give parts to gay people playing gay roles. So yeah, it would have to be a gay disabled actor, which I know of one other one, and I'm sure there are more, but it definitely is a limited pool.
Right. So, you know, it sort of worked out that way.
Yes.
I mean, this did in fact arise from you doing blog posts like your character in the show. And blog posts beget a book.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
What are
such
the
odds? Such a world we live in. I was writing blog posts that were, excuse me, it's going to get nauseous in here. They were going viral. And so I had some book agents kind of peek their head out and be like, okay. So I ended up signing with Simon & Schuster, but the book that I ended up selling them was not the book that I ended up writing. I ended up selling this book that was all about being a millennial, which like sounds totally gross now, but in 2011 was actually considered like groundbreaking. So I sold the book, and at the time I was closeted about my disability. I had gotten hit by a car at 20, and I moved to
New York. Okay, wait, we got to stop for a second here because this is one of the striking things to me and makes me feel some hope for tomorrow.
Yeah.
That your character is out as far as being gay. That's not even the thing.
Oh, yeah, honey.
But you're actually, nobody would think you could even be in the closet about a disability. That's
crazy. I know. Well, it's all about disabled privilege. Like, I have a mild case. So, like, you can dress her up, you can dress her down. She can, like, you know what I mean? So, when I moved to New York, everyone assumed my limp was from my car accident.
You had a real car. I mean, you had a real car. I want to just be clear. There is a car accident in the show, but there is a real car accident that is far more serious than the accident.
Way more serious. Yes. I got hit by a car that was going 45 miles per hour. It just clipped me. If I had hit me head on, I would have died. But it just clipped my elbow, and it created such pressure in the elbow that the oxygen supply of my hand got cut off. So I started losing hand function. And then I had like 4 surgeries. Then I was in the hospital for about a month. And then I had a couple more surgeries over the span of 2 years. It was gnarly. I was one-handed for about a year. And I read
somewhere that it was your better side was not the side.
Yeah,
it was
the side that of course hit. It hits the side that's not affected by CP. Like, of course it does, honey.
Of course.
So now I'm just left with 2 meh sides. Yeah. So
permanently,
anyway,
really?
Permanently meh. Yeah, mm-hmm. Permanently meh. But, you know, look, I feel like I was a more an advantage to deal with this accident because I had grown up disabled. So I was kind of used to things being taken away from me. Like, if anyone knows how to compensate, it's me. And so I think I was just better prepared to learn how to deal with having a hand that just is half function is gone. But it was pretty intense. And in the show, it's really just like he gets
hit
by a car and he's fine.
Because
it's like you don't have the room to have that be the story. But it really happened. You know, I moved to New York and yeah, people assumed my limbs from an accident. And I never
really...
You're
like a true writer. You used the material to tell your story, even though the story wasn't
I know. I mean, by the way, it didn't even strike me as that crazy until I remember coming out about it, and people were so like thought that was so interesting that I would think being an accident victim was better than being disabled. But to me, anyone can get hit by a car. It's something that you can understand very easily, whereas I say the word cerebral palsy and it's met with confusion and people don't understand, because cerebral palsy can look different literally on everybody. Like, the cases can run the gamut from, you know, mild to wild. So like, it was just much easier for me to be an accident victim. It was less complicated.
It's relatable.
Yeah. I thought I did a giant life hack. But like, the reality was I was like lying about a large part of who I was, which was creating a lot of emotional problems. Like, you know, it's in the show, like, running from who you are is hard, especially if you have a limp. Like, I really believe that. Like, you can't, honey. Like, cerebral palsy will always catch up. She's slow, but she gets there.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. So the coming out was...
So I knew at the time when I sold my book, I was like, I can't write a book about my life and not include my cerebral palsy. Also, I think lying about my cerebral palsy is causing me a lot of harm, because at the time I got the book deal, I was addicted to drugs. And I feel like deep down, I kind of knew that I was self-medicating to just deal with the pain. You know, you have these weird insights, I think, even at a young age, where your brain kind of like gasps for help and you kind of have to answer that call. And I think that like... And I think that book deal, I was like, if I tell Simon & Schuster this, I'm officially on the hook to come clean about my cerebral palsy, and I'm like held accountable. And this is the way to do it. So Simon & Schuster, I told them. And, you know, they were like, great. They were really encouraging. They're like, you should write about your disability. So I started writing about my disability, which was really crazy and very strange, because I had just totally repressed it for the last like 6 years. Even before I was 20 and got hit by a car, I still did not talk about my disability. Like, my disability was never discussed. Like, it was just a lot of unpacking through the book. But I still didn't quite understand what a disservice I had done to myself by being closeted about my disability. So I feel like the show is a really great way to explore that in a way that I was not emotionally aware of in the book. You know what I mean?
Well, it's like a therapy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you, at some point, you are pitching this idea for a show.
Yeah.
You didn't want to go to a network.
No, never. Oh my God, no. My agents at the time were like, you have to go to NBC, ABC, CBS, Max. And I was like, I would rather die. I mean, because I knew that they would probably buy it because it was cerebral palsy and it was gay and it was exciting. And then they would be like, what actually have we bought? We bought a show about a gay disabled person. And then it would just die in development. Or they would buy it and, you know, best case scenario, it would get made. But the script would so not resemble anything that I would want. And so much about the story that I want to tell is tied into sexuality and like you know, the desires of a disabled gay person and exploring the fact that they're horny as f- and they like want to have sex and that's okay.
Right.
I couldn't do that on CBS, honey.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
maybe like mildly, but not really.
You
could have urges, right?
Yeah. I'd be like, I wish a boy would kiss me. That's it.
That's where it stops.
Like, ah! You know what I mean? Like, so I refused to do that. But then we went to cable and, you know, I had my gay mafia with me, you know, my close friend, Craig Johnson, who's a director. And then John Rege, who's a producer on 30 Rock and The Comeback. And then Jim Parsons, of course.
Oh, yes. You know, Jim Parsons had read the
book? Jim Parsons optioned it. I had a couple of studios interested, but I loved Jim so much. Like, I'm scared of famous people because they're psychotic. But Jim, so when Jim was like calling,
mostly.
I was scared. I was like teeth chattering. Like, I was like, I don't know how this is gonna go. And him and his partner Todd are seriously the most wonderful, kind, funny people, and so smart. There was a couple other studios interested, but I just felt like everyone else was just sort of like very businessy and very Hollywood, and I didn't like that. And I just felt like Jim and Todd hadn't even hired an exec for their production company yet. It was the first thing they ever saw. So there was like a purity to the whole thing. So we were just like a bunch of like weird virgins, like embarking.
I was going to say, you were virgins together.
We were virgins together. And we're like, I don't know, it was a very like unique experience. And it like, we really became close, I think, in a way that isn't normal for the development process, just because we weren't seasoned.
Don't try this one at home, kids. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but anyway, ended up not selling, which was devastating.
To cable.
Yeah. To cable. I mean,
everybody was like, that's so interesting. We're not buying it.
I think some of them were scared. I think that the landscape was so different. I mean, 2015 was only 4 years ago, but think about it. Like, they were just realizing that like women were funny. So gay disability was like way down the
right,
list. They were like, what's that?
Right.
We'll deal with that in 4 years, honey. Your time hasn't come yet. Wait in line.
They
really weren't ready for this jelly. But I think everything that I've accomplished in my career or not accomplished, I can really attribute to luck and timing. That really is, you have to be at the right time, the right place, and the zeitgeist has to be ready for it. And they just weren't ready for it in 2015.
Coming up after a short break, Ryan O'Connell tells us why that peach scene in Call Me By Your Name left him still hungry. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Ryan O'Connell, creator and star of the new autobiographical Netflix series Special, a coming-of-age comedy based on O'Connell's experiences as a young gay man with cerebral palsy. Special is the first time Netflix has done a short-form series. The 8 episodes are just about 15 minutes long each. O'Connell would like them to be longer, but he still tackles a lot in the time allotted, from dating to sex to a new job to an evolving relationship with his mom, played by Jessica Hecht. She tries to be supportive when her son insists on escaping the suburbs and getting his own apartment in L.A. But when moving day comes, she struggles while watching Ryan struggle to open a taped box.
Ryan, stop. Look, are you sure you want to do this?
Mom, yes, I'm sure.
There's just so much stuff that you don't know how to do. At least let me do the end table.
No, God, I don't need your help. I can figure it out.
Even normal people ask for help.
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I not normal?
Despite the backing of Big Bang Theory star Jim Parsons, getting Special into production was neither quick nor easy.
So you ended up at this Warner's...
Yeah, this digital branch of Warner Brothers Stage 13, and they were doing short-form content from multi-hyphenates. So I was going to write all the scripts, and I was going to act in them. But I was still working on shows. So I wrote the scripts for Special when I was on Will and Grace. And then Will and Grace wrapped. And then we sent the scripts to Netflix. And Netflix hadn't done short form before. But they really liked the scripts. And so they just bought them as
is. They can do any form they want.
Exactly.
Netflix.
Yeah.
But the one thing that I think I read was that you weren't so sold on doing the 15-minute, the short.
No, I didn't want to do that. Not like in a bratty way. I just am used to half hours. So I couldn't even conceive of 15 minutes. And obviously, like, as a writer, you want the space to tell the story you want to tell. And I just thought it would be too limiting. But I think in the end, it was actually incredible because writing a show, 15 pages, 15 minutes, you learn to become incredibly economical. And you really understand that there's an A story and there's a B story. And that B story is a little bit of a runner. So that's what you have, and you work within those confines. And I think having it stripped down the way it was, it really just teaches you that every single line needs to get you somewhere. It was like a weird boot camp for
me.
Discipline. It was totally disciplined. That being said, season two would love 22 minutes to half an hour.
If you're listening.
If we're listening, yeah, totally. And I think that is pretty much loud and clear. So I think if we do return, it will be hopefully in 22 minutes, half hour.
And there were budget constraints as well.
Yeah, yeah. We weren't like, you know, it wasn't a Game of Thrones. Let's put it that way.
You know, I'm going to get to the sex.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course.
Something that I certainly hadn't seen before, but I'm not the only one, which is the first time I've seen rather sweet, gay, deflowering, pretty explicit sex scene in there.
Yeah.
Did anybody go, uh-uh?
No. My voice, for better or for worse, is incredibly specific, and I'm very clear about what I want. And so anyone that gets into business with me knows what they're getting, and they know that I'm like incredibly sex positive, and they know that normalizing gay sex is a big deal for me because I just don't know why it's like not shown. Like, I'm really glad that we're talking about the sex scene, but I want to get to a place where it's totally like NBD. Like, but we don't live in that space
we're not
right
in
now,
that world, no.
Which is like fine, but I just don't get it. Like, I saw girls, and girls like revolutionized the way that I saw sex on TV, but that was straight sex, not gay sex.
Right.
So gay sex is its own can of worms. Mm-hmm. And I think like it was just really exciting for me to explore that and do so in a very human and realistic way that's not really played for laughs, but can still be funny and warm and humiliating and comforting all in the same scene.
Yeah, you know? I saw that you felt that it was a bit frustrating in Call Me By Your Name, like they build up, and then cut away.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that. I just felt like we had been bait and switched. As gay men, we're like so starving for representation that like we truly like will take any scraps given to us and we'll show up because we're like, yeah, it's like literally we've been like starving. But I feel like that movie, I mean, here's the thing about Call Me By Your Name. I actually really like that movie and it's incredibly well done, but I couldn't understand why you would show Timothée Chalamet f*** a peach, f*** a woman, and then have the whole movie be designed around desire between these two men, and then they consummate the relationship, and then you just don't show it. I couldn't believe it. We can have a whole movie that's predicated upon gay desire, but we can't actually watch them consummate it. No, that's gone too far. I just couldn't believe it. That really got my goat.
It got your goat. And but your team that you work with at various places, I think I read that it's all gay.
Yeah. I try to live a life that's like very curated where it's like gay men and women. Like I knew like when I was looking for directors that I wanted to work with either a gay guy or a woman. And to me, I'm just really comfortable around gay men and women. And this is a story about a marginalized person. It's very intimate. It's very vulnerable. I just want to feel comfortable with people that get it, that have also been in that space and they know what it's like. And again, it's all about giving jobs to people that don't have them traditionally or giving a chance on someone that ordinarily wouldn't have it. So yeah, wasn't very straight.
It wasn't
and
very
that's
straight.
That's the way Mama likes it.
That's the way she likes it. We're hoping for a special season. They haven't told you.
No, they haven't told. But, you know, I will say the response has been so overwhelmingly positive. Like, it's incredible. It's beyond my... I wasn't... You know, it's my first Netflix show, so I don't know what to expect. And so just...
Well, you know, I saw that, you know, that the rap is they throw you out there and you sail off and maybe nobody ever hears of you.
Yeah. Well, it's so crazy because that so has not been my experience with Netflix. Like, they've really championed this show and, like, they give me billboards. Like, I'm an unknown person. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not a star by any means. So, like, the fact that they've invested so much into this show and we're not Grace and Frankie. So it's like that goodwill is actually incredible to me. But the response from the show, it's been really validating because I think when I first went out with this show, I was like, I know this sounds like a weird show, but, like, trust me, it's not. It's a fish out of water. It's classic. It's not, I'm not reinventing the story wheel here. I'm just showing a character that hasn't been seen on television. So like seeing people from all walks of life, like send me messages and they're not just gay and disabled people. They're people of all kinds. Like it's been just completely like affirming.
Ryan O'Connell is the creator and star of the new Netflix series Special. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's show with production assistance this week from Phil Richards and Paul Smith. You can listen to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.